give me liberty or give me death. We all know that it was Patrick Henry who uttered those immortal words, but do you know anything at all about Patrick Henry beyond that speech? We've talked about him before on this program, and today we're happy to welcome John Ragosta to the show. He's a professor of history at Randolph College, and he is going to tell us all about Patrick Henry's important place in American constitutional history, especially with regard to one particular incident involving the suppression of free speech and efforts to combat it. To Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Patrick Henry of Virginia and Kentucky.
Don't change that station. It's time for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Do you remember back when you were in eighth grade, you heard about something called the Alien and Sedition Acts? You might have spent maybe 5 minutes talking about them. Maybe you recall that they were the low point in the one-term presidency of John Adams, who had done so much for the revolutionary cause up to that point and who sullied his reputation with two statutes that really were in direct violation of the First Amendment, especially the speech and press clauses. All across this great nation of ours, people, including newspaper editors and even one member of Congress, were being put in jail for opposing the government. Well, one voice that was raised in opposition to this tyranny was someone who might surprise you, a fellow who had earlier raised his voice in opposition to English tyranny, now combated it in his own country. His name was Patrick Henry, and here to tell us all about him is John Ragosta.
Stuart, good afternoon. I'm John Ragosta. I'm currently a fellow at the Virginia Foundation for Humanities and a visiting professor at Randolph College in Lynchburg. And when I'm not doing that, I've been writing history books.
Well, what kind of history books have you been writing, John?
Well, I've done two books on the development of religious freedom. And most recently, I finished a short biography of Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry Proclaiming a Revolution came out from Routledge Press in 2016.
So it's just on the shelves now?
Yes, sir.
And it's all about, I'm guessing, Patrick Henry.
Yes, Patrick Henry, in many ways, one of the great forgotten founders. I mean, everybody remembers that Henry said something. Didn't he say something? It was, you know, we remember a speech, give me liberty, give me death. But at the time of the Revolution, he's really central to what happens. He's the most popular politician in Virginia, with the exception of Washington after the Revolution, certainly more popular than Jefferson. And yet today, we don't really remember much about Henry.
No, we don't. That's funny you should say it that way, because just the other day I was giving a lecture on the First Amendment, and the subject of Patrick Henry came up very briefly, and I said, so he said that thing, right? That liberty or death thing. And they all, you know, sort of nodding, and I said, do you know one other thing about him? And they all laughed, because, of course, nobody did.
The answer is no. And there's, you know, interesting reasons for that. Some of it's not just academic or historic forgetfulness. Thomas Jefferson, who really came to hate Henry, spent the last 27 years of his life trying to undermine Patrick Henry's historic memory and was very successful at doing so.
So this was a plot.
It was absolutely a plot. I mean, Jefferson, we can talk about why Jefferson disliked Henry. He started out early in life. Henry was older, and Jefferson really idolized Henry to some extent. But over the course of their careers, he came to hate Henry. Henry dies in 1799. Jefferson lives to 1826. And Jefferson spends decades talking to biographers, young historians, young academics, basically saying Henry was stupid, he didn't do anything, he couldn't read, he couldn't write, he was a demagogue. Pay no attention to Henry.
My gosh, it sounds like what he did to George Washington.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Jefferson and Washington have an interesting relation, too, as your question indicates. Jefferson also, while Henry and Washington were still alive, tries to set them against each other. He tells his supporters, tell Henry that Washington dislikes you. People tell Washington that Henry dislikes you. In fact, Washington and Henry were very close colleagues, very much enamored with each other. Henry idolized Washington. But that's not the way Jefferson told the story.
That is remarkable. In fact, it's this. I know we're going to talk about Patrick Henry today, but inevitably you have to talk about other founders. And the more one learns about Thomas Jefferson, well, at least the more I learn about him, the less I like him.
Well,
I mean, he's got all kinds of good stuff. He's got cred, Declaration of Independence.
But he has issues.
He had major issues. I mean, there's the slave thing. There's the Sally Hemings thing. And then there's the lying and the backbiting. And this guy was a major league backstabber and conspirator.
Right. You did not want to be on Jefferson's bad side. And one of the things that's interesting is if you compare Jefferson's relationship with Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, who he very much disagrees with politically, but he never hates Hamilton personally. Mm-hmm. He puts a bust of Hamilton in Monticello. I mean, he respects Hamilton's contributions to the country. Henry, he hates. And believe me, there's no bust of Henry at Monticello.
Well, I'm just going to float a theory here, and this is off the wall, but something strikes me. One of his criticisms of both Washington and Henry, and I've just learned this from you, was that they weren't all that. They weren't very bright. They weren't particularly accomplished. They weren't worth listening to. But everybody knows that Hamilton was one of the smartest guys on the block. I wonder if this is just a bit of intellectual elitism, that Jefferson looks down on anyone he doesn't consider his intellectual equal.
I mean, I think that's an interesting theory. We could explore that. I think he has other reasons for hating Henry. He blames Henry for the 1781 investigation of his governorship,
right,
which basically said that Jefferson was not only incompetent but a coward. And Jefferson
right.
really
you'll have to, is. You'll have to get a little background on that. That's where Jefferson ran away from the British.
Right. The British have invaded. Jefferson's the governor. Henry had been governor for 3 years. Henry is the first governor of Virginia. He is reelected twice. He's governor for 3 years, which is the maximum number permitted under the Constitution at the time. Jefferson is the second governor. The British invade while Jefferson is governor. They take over Richmond, and then Jefferson's in Charlottesville with the legislature. They send the British redcoats out to capture Jefferson and the legislature. The legislature flees to Staunton, and Jefferson goes to Poplar Forest, his home down in the southwest of Virginia. Mm-hmm. And he's accused, he basically abandons the legislature, and his term is up, and he tells the legislature, you need a new governor. It should be somebody with military experience. That's not me. And he leaves. Now, with hindsight, Jefferson should have gone with them until there was a new governor elected. Mm-hmm. But the legislature decides to investigate. And the actual investigation is launched by someone else, but Jefferson blames Henry. And historians still argue about this. Some historians would say Henry is responsible. I believe Henry was responsible. Others say Henry was not. But that doesn't matter. Jefferson believed that Henry was responsible. And Jefferson is an 18th century Virginia gentleman. Henry basically has challenged his honor. He said he's a coward. He said he's incompetent. And Jefferson hates Henry. Within a year, Jefferson is saying he's all tongue and neither heart nor head. Now, you know, this is a great insult. I always tell my students, if you want to know how to insult, read Jefferson. You know, he says Henry is all tongue with neither heart nor head.
That is a good insult.
Yeah, that is a good insult.
Well, we've gotten kind of off on a Jefferson tangent here, and that's fine. But what strikes me now is that I think the primary focus of our discussion today is going to be something called the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. And that, strangely, is a circumstance where I think Henry was on the same side as Jefferson, wasn't he?
Well, no, they are actually, and that's the second great incident. Henry ends up, you would think he was on the same side, but he's not. He's opposed
okay.
to Jefferson.
Then I'm completely lost and discombobulated, and probably half the people listening now are lost and discombobulated because we've really just sort of jumped in the middle of this thing. Let's back up. Our subject is Patrick Henry. Let's give the brief outline of who he was and where that famous speech fit in, and then let's focus on the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which was one of his great contributions to American constitutional history. So who was this guy, Patrick Henry?
Well, Patrick Henry, of course, he's one of the people who is said to launch the revolution from the Parsons Cause back in 1763, where he challenges the king and says the king has to be a good king to be a legitimate king. Stamp Act resolutions, that's Patrick Henry, where he says, you know, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles had his Cromwell basically threatening the king with being assassinated, and people scream treason, treason. And then when the revolution comes, 1775, in his most famous speech, he says Virginia must arm. The British are coming with guns and ships. They're not coming to negotiate. And everybody remembers the end of that speech where he says, peace, peace, men cry peace. And he ends with, give me liberty or give me death. He becomes the first governor of Virginia. He's governor of Virginia for 3 years during the Revolution. Very intimately involved in sending supplies to Valley Forge. He becomes very close with George Washington and is a very successful governor. Only man elected 6 times to the governorship of Virginia over the course of his career.
And participates as part of in the Revolution as part of the Virginia militia.
He is in the militia for a short period of time. That doesn't really work out very well for Henry. And when he resigns from the militia and goes back to the legislature, George Washington actually says that's where he belongs. You know, Virginia made a mistake. Henry made a mistake sending him into the field. This man belongs in the Senate. And, you know, when we think about the Revolution, we like to think about George Washington and winning these battles, maybe Thomas Jefferson and John Adams in Philadelphia. But there's a lot going on in the state capitals. You had to have somebody running the state, getting the troops together to send to Washington, keeping the economy going. And that's really Henry. He's also intimately involved in the capture of the Northwest Territories by George Rogers Clark, that he helps plan and fund that effort. So he's critical in the Revolution. After the Revolution, he becomes, and this then leads into the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, he becomes the greatest anti-federalist. When the Constitution is proposed coming out of Philadelphia, goes to the states for ratification, it's really hit or miss. And Stuart, your listeners may know this, but we tend to forget the Constitution was really a close thing.
A very close thing, yeah. And those who were in favor of it called themselves Federalists, perhaps after the series of articles that Madison and Hamilton and Jay wrote, simply called The Federalist. And so you had people in favor of the Constitution were the Federalists, and then rather unimaginatively, those who were opposed to it for various reasons were the Anti-Federalists.
I always liked Elbridge Gerry said we should call them the rats, the ratification people, and the anti-rats. so he had a different view. But we'll stick with Federalists and Anti-Federalists because people are familiar with that. So Henry, and many people believe there were, if you had a popular vote, you know, if we'd had a popular vote, the Constitution probably would not have been adopted. Henry is the great Anti-Federalist. He's concerned about no Bill of Rights. He's concerned about the federal government is too strong and too distant, and it's going to take power unto itself and hurt states' rights. He's concerned about the idea that we've created an empire, and they're already talking about empire in the 1780s. Mm-hmm. We've created an empire, but at the cost of our liberties. And in many ways, Henry is the progenitor of what becomes the Jefferson-Madison Democratic Republican Party in the 1790s.
Which is an odd thing, you have to say here, because, of course, Madison and from afar, and implicitly Jefferson, were Federalists at this point. Now, Jefferson had his doubts, and he really wasn't part of the process, but Madison was sort of the uber-Federalist. He was the guy who was out there arguing in favor of the Constitution up in New York and in Virginia and everywhere he could. And Henry, if he made a contribution to the Constitution, it was pointing out that it needed a Bill of Rights. And it's when they made a compromise over that, and the compromise was basically, you know, you ratify and we'll give you a Bill of Rights, first order of business. Arguably, Patrick Henry became one of the major contributors to the Constitution. Okay, but the Constitution, as it was originally formed, was very much it was federal in the sense that it had both national and state governments. But many people saw it as a very nationalist sort of constitution. And what you're saying is that down the road, people started having doubts about that. And that's when Henry and Madison and Jefferson actually started moving somewhat in the same direction.
Well, they do for a period. And then they sort of flip that because initially, as you say, Madison is a great Federalist. By the 1790s, and he's specifically talking about exactly the things that Henry had raised in the ratification debates. Madison starts to say, you know, that necessary and proper clause, Congress can do anything necessary and proper to fulfill its other obligations. Gee, that gives Congress a lot of power. That was something Henry had been talking about. Gee, that general welfare clause, Congress can act in the general welfare of the United States, that gives Congress pretty unbounded power, something that Henry had been talking about. So Madison and Jefferson become the heads of this Democratic Republican Party, which is very concerned about excessive government power, states' rights, and the abuse of power.
And those are the things that Henry had been concerned about all the time.
Absolutely. As I said, Henry in many ways is the forefather of what becomes the Jeffersonian, Madisonian, Democratic Republican Party.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. This week I'm speaking with John Ragosta, who's a visiting professor at Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia. We've had John on the show before. He writes books, and when he writes them, we talk about them. This time he's written a book about Patrick Henry. And specifically today, we're talking about Patrick Henry's role, not so much in the Revolution, but in our later constitutional history. After the break, we will have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with John Ragosta. Stay tuned. Looks like the quiz guy is here today. He's got his sleeves rolled up. He is ready to rock and roll, or at least that's what you look like.
Thanks. I feel like a rock and roller.
Well, you've got a great big set of headphones on, so maybe you could be a tech guy for a rock and roller.
The problem is I feel like an old rock and roller.
Well, most rock and rollers these days, I think, are pretty old.
Sad but true.
Sad but true.
They are indeed sad. But maybe true as well.
Maybe true as well. Do we have a contestant?
Yes, we do. I'm Carly from Knoxville.
Carly from Knoxville. And it sounds to me, Carly, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are of the female persuasion.
I am.
I'm so pleased. We don't get nearly as many women. In fact, I'm going to make this a plea. Women, we need you to call us. I'm going to announce the next time we record some quizzes, and I'm going to announce it on our Facebook page. And I want me some women. I want women on the show. We need more female voices. So thank you for helping us plug the gap a little bit, Carly. What kind of quiz question do you have for Carly, Doug?
Well, we've got a question. It's a yes or no question today,
a
Carly.
A yes or no question.
Yep. So your choices are going to be yes or no. Are you ready for the question?
I am.
All right. In 2013, the state of Illinois passed a law outlawing the burning of the American flag. Is that enforceable? Yes, the state can prosecute if the violation occurs in that state. Or B, no, that's protected speech by the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Carly, yes or no? Can Illinois penalize you for burning an American flag?
It's a 2013 case.
It sounds like you just burned yourself there.
I probably did. I would say no.
What? I can go out and just burn an American flag in Illinois and they can't punish me for it?
I mean, they were doing it in New York City.
Well, New York City, of course they do it in New York City. They're all a bunch of leftists up there, but my Illinois, I mean, that's middle America. That's the heartland. We can burn flags in Illinois?
When she said that, a little bit of Lee Greenwood died.
Are you going to stick with your answer, Carly?
I guess so. I don't know. Sure, why not?
Sure, why not, Doug?
She is correct.
Well done, Carly. You're exactly right.
It is protected speech by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and we know this all the way back to Johnson v. Texas, don't we?
Indeed, we do. In a 1989 case where a fellow down in Texas named Johnson burned an American flag. There was a march. It was in protest of the Republican convention, I think, or... It was an anti-Republican protest, and these protesters were marching down the street, and they hauled down an American flag that they came across, and they burned it publicly and even chanted some really objectionable things. It was, I think the chant was, red, white, and blue, we spit on you, and then they did so. So, I mean, these guys were really doing offensive things, the things that most people would find very offensive. And it turns out that really the only actionable crime that occurred that day was the theft of the flag.
Oh, really?
Because it wasn't their flag. It was just like some... you know, yeah. And you can't do that, okay? So, I mean, you can't steal people's stuff or vandalize it.
Yeah. And then light it on fire.
And then light it on fire. But the actual crime they were charged with was a Texas statute which criminalized the burning of flags. But here's the thing. It only criminalized it when you were doing it for political reasons, okay? It didn't criminalize it, for example, when the Boy Scouts would have their flag-burning ceremonies. In fact, they do. That sounds strange, but the way to dispose of a flag properly and reverently is to burn it in a ceremony because you don't want flags, you know, in landfills. You don't want them hanging off of garbage cans and alleyways, and so you want to destroy the flag completely. So a Boy Scout doing it reverently, that's okay. But Mr. Johnson doing it irreverently, that's not okay. And so the real difference there is that you're penalizing one form of speech and not the other.
Well, you know, this comes up all the time. I mean, we're even seeing this in the newly forming Trump administration.
Yes, the president-elect has just recently tweeted, as of today, that people who burn the flag should either be in jail or...
Is it deported?
I think stripped of their citizenship.
Yeah, that's it. Stripped of the citizenship.
Yeah, I think it's already getting some backlash. In fact, I hear that the Senate Majority Leader, Mr. McConnell, has already weighed in and say, you know, pointing out that that's not really constitutional. It's protected speech.
Well, and maybe more surprising to President-elect Trump, really not his role.
Yeah, for the most part, that sort of crime is not the sort of thing that the federal officials would be involved with at all. It would be local officials in all likelihood. And again, you can arrest people for vandalizing other people's property or for stealing it, but you just can't penalize thought or speech.
Stuart, do you think we're entering into an interesting time in America's kind of protection of political speech? Because there seems to be a lot on all sides of the spectrum, not just left and right, but you know, everywhere.
There really does. In fact, we've done an episode. We've talked about flag burning in the past, but we recently did an episode on the other end of the political spectrum. Some people who are on campus around the nation who are trying to do the right thing with regard to equality and trying to protect people from what they say is hate speech. And again, it's very objectionable speech, racial epithets, inappropriate comments that are directed at people because of who they are. Nobody likes that, or at least most people don't like that. But can you penalize them for it, especially if you're a state institution? And the answer, by and large, unless there's some sort of threat or some sort of incitement to violence or some other exception to the First Amendment's protections, the answer is no.
And this is a huge surprise to our European listeners.
I know.
Because
it
they
really
have
is.
Very strict regulations about speech.
Yeah, hate speech is far more regulated in Europe, and I think that's understandable when you consider the recent history there, okay, and the rise of fascism in the 30s and the horrible things that happened. It's understandable, but at the risk of sounding chauvinistic, I think our approach is the better approach. I mean, you've got to be able to protect speech that people find offensive. Inoffensive speech doesn't need protection, you know? Good morning, how are you today? Don't you look nice? Nobody's going to object to that. Okay, but when I get out and say something objectionable, that's when they'll try to penalize me. And so if you don't protect offensive speech, then you may as well not have a First Amendment.
And what we've seen is that the Supreme Court, year after year, really holds political speech to such a high bar.
It is the most protected speech. It's called core political speech.
Core
and
political
we have a
speech.
Very speech protective court. Now, Justice Scalia was part of that. And of course, we don't know who the next justice will be at the time of this quiz. But I think that the majority is so strong. Indeed, for most. In fact, the most recent hate speech case was the military hate speech case, the military, the funeral.
GodHatesFags.com.
Oh, horrible. Yeah, horrible people saying horrible Terrible. Things and to people at a very vulnerable moment. That speech was protected, and that was an 8-1 vote, I believe. And so even Justice Scalia's changing is not going to change that majority. At any rate, fascinating question. You got it right, Carly. So send us an email or send us a message on Facebook. Give us your T-shirt size. We'll put one in the mail to you along with a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier so that you can point out that First Amendment to people whenever they suggest that you can arrest flag burners.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. And thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue my conversation with John Ragosta, who teaches history at Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia. He's just recently written a book, John has, about Patrick Henry, and we're talking about that book today, but we're specifically focusing upon Henry's constitutional contributions. certainly he was important in the Revolution, but it turns out that he was also an important opponent of the ratification of our Constitution. And although that might tempt you to think of him as sort of a constitutional villain, no, he had good reasons for his opposition, and they always centered around individual liberty.
And Henry was the consistent one. He had those concerns all along, and even though he somewhat grudgingly eventually supported the Constitution, he was pretty consistent, you correct me if I'm wrong, whereas it was Madison who really sort of flip-flopped between his nationalist perspective and then his states' rights perspective later.
Absolutely. Okay. Madison is the one who changes. But a very important incident happens at the end of the Virginia Ratification Convention, which I then think sets up the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. At the end of the ratification, it's a very close vote in Virginia. I think it was 89 to 79. So it would not have taken too many votes to flip for Virginia to reject the Constitution, which New York would have then rejected, North Carolina rejected, Rhode Island rejected. It would have been a very different world. At the end of this very contentious, almost month-long convention, the Anti-Federalists just barely lose. George Mason, who's one of the great Anti-Federalists as well, with Henry, basically calls a meeting in Richmond after the vote. And at this meeting, he gathers a bunch of the Anti-Federalists, and he says, okay, what are we going to do to interfere with this? How are we going to basically engage in guerrilla warfare against the new Constitution? And which is really astounding. I mean, George Mason is talking about trying to undermine the Constitution, which Virginia had just voted to adopt. Henry is at the meeting, and everybody knows Henry's the real leader of the Anti-Federalists. And there's some dispute about what Henry says, but I think based on his speech at the convention on the final day, Henry stands up and says, this is wrong. We lost. We voted for the Constitution. I'm going to do my best to fix what I perceive to be the problems, like the lack of a Bill of Rights. I'm going to encourage a Bill of Rights. But our obligation as good citizens is to go home and be peaceable. This is an enormous service to the country. I mean, if Henry had joined Mason and said, that's right, what can we do? Let's throw bombs. Let's try to undermine this effort. Again, a very different world if Virginia had been in active opposition to the Constitution. So Henry had made that clear that he opposed the Constitution. He thought the federal government was going to be too powerful. It was going to abuse its power. Madison and Jefferson come to that conclusion. But he's very clear, we have to live within the law. You don't simply go out and ignore the law or take the law into your own hands.
And that is very important. That's the essence of democracy. And it's one of the most difficult parts of democracy is losing.
Right.
You know, you go out and you take a vote. And I don't know about you, but I've certainly been on the losing side of a lot of elections. And there are a lot of people right now who were on the losing side of the elections of 2016. And it's hard. And they're having a hard time with that. And they're trying to figure out what they should do. And the idea that you peaceably accept an election is essential to the functioning of democracy.
And you act within the law. And again, we could talk about the 2016 election. That's an interesting episode.
Right.
But certainly at the time when the country's just forming and we don't really have a history, mm-hmm. for Henry to create the idea of a loyal opposition, you know, I'm opposed, but I'm going to work within the law.
Right.
So, for example, Virginia elects Anti-Federalist senators to the first Congress. Most of the other states did not. Even the states where there was a very large Anti-Federalist contingent, the Anti-Federalists, after they lost the vote, seemed to disappear. And Henry is doing the right thing, so to speak. He says, no, you know, we lost, but now we're going to work within the system to try to fix this.
Yeah.
And that's how you get the Bill of Rights.
We lost the vote, but we're not dead. And we're going to try to influence the system from our perspective.
Right. And so he does that. And it's really, in some ways, that thinking that Madison and Jefferson then become engaged in, and you get the Bill of Rights and the developments into the 1790s. But then things go awry at the end of the 1790s, and that's when you get into the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions.
Okay. So what happened that was so bad in the 1790s?
What really happens is the French Revolution, and right. Britain and France are going to be at war pretty much constantly until 1815 when Napoleon's finally defeated.
Right. And the Bastille was in 1789, right?
Right. So you have 25 years of basically British-French war off and on, but almost constant. And both sides are trying to pull the United States in. Washington says right up front, we're going to be neutral. We're not going to get engaged in this. And the French are saying, hey, we helped you in the Revolution. You need to help us. And Washington declares neutrality.
Which is a pretty compelling argument, by the way.
Yes. Oh, the French had a good point.
They had a very good point. I mean, without them, you know, things could have been different. They really did stand up for us. Now, they had their interests. They had their interests. They weren't doing this completely out of the goodness of their heart. But the French helped us. They were our allies. And then just a few years later, you know, a dozen years later, they're at war with Britain. And we just sort of say, well, you're on your own, guys.
You're on your own. And Jefferson, of course, is not happy with that. But Washington then negotiates a treaty with the British, the Jay Treaty, very unpopular treaty, but basically at least leaves us at peace with Britain.
And that was in 1795, right?
Right, okay. Right, 1795, so halfway through the decade.
Most people these days have never heard of the Jay Treaty. For most people, the 1790 is sort of a dark hole. They don't really know what was going on then. It's a fascinating first decade of the existence of our national government, the two terms of George Washington, the single term of John Adams, and then ultimately the election of 1800, where Jefferson won a very close contest with Aaron Burr, of all people. Fascinating decade. But as you say, the Jay Treaty was, at least it attempted to be, sort of a settlement of outstanding issues, many of which had been left over since the Revolution, with the British. Jay goes over, he negotiates it, he brings it back, he does the best thing he can, but people hate him for it. And they're burning him in effigy up and down the East Coast.
Right, he's burned in effigy. And I think, Stuart, to take a step back, I think in some ways what you said leads up to what we're talking about. There's mm-hmm. a real constitutional crisis in the 1790s that we tend to have forgotten about. And it's because the nation is new. Nobody's quite sure how this is going to work in the federal versus the state governments. And on top of that, Washington and Adams are trying desperately to stay out of this war because they think if we get engaged in this war, our nation is still fragile. We won't survive. We'll become either a colony of France or England.
Probably right.
And they were probably right. So, you know, the Jay Treaty is going to keep us out of a war with Britain. But the French take offense. They say, well, now you're basically at war with us. If you're going to be on Britain's side, and we weren't really on Britain's side, but if you're going to be on Britain's side, we have what is referred to as a quasi-war with France. And American ships are shooting at French ships. French ships are shooting at American ships. They're taking prisoners. The military budget is being increased. Adams is president, and it's referred to as the quasi-war. And this is when the Alien and Sedition Acts are passed, which mm-hmm. people have, you know, we sort of hear about that. Well, the Alien Act says that the president of the United States can deport any alien basically for any reason. And that's targeted at the French.
That sounds strangely timely, John, but go on.
Yes, and very disturbing. Pretty clearly a constitutional violation, but the Congress passes it. And then worse, they pass the Sedition Act. And this is where Jefferson and Madison are going to get very upset. The Sedition Act basically makes it illegal to criticize the Congress or the President of the United States.
Wow. Say that again, please. This is the Sedition Act. Say
the
that.
Sedition
this is big.
Act. Yeah. It is big. It makes it illegal. It is illegal. You can go to jail, and dozens of people do go to jail for criticizing the Congress or the President of the United States.
That is so extraordinary. The thing is, just I have to put the dates in here. This is 1798, okay, sedition. 1791, we'd ratified this thing called the First Amendment, which had said Congress shall make no law infringing freedom of speech or of the press.
That's right. And this is pretty clearly a violation of the First Amendment.
You've got Congress passing a law infringing freedom of speech and of the press. I mean, this is about the most direct violation of the speech and press clauses one could imagine.
And it's because of a war scare, you know, bringing it back to what are the implications today? You know, people are concerned about war. We may have a war. So we're going to give the president and Congress all this authority. And it's dangerous. But what I was going to say, by the way, this Sedition Act does not make it illegal. You are permitted to criticize the vice president of the United States.
Oh,
who's
my.
The vice president?
That would be Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, my.
So this is a Federalist law, and it's intended to protect the Federalist Congress and the Federalist administration against criticism. Jefferson and Madison and the Democratic Republicans are appalled, absolutely appalled, clear violation of the First Amendment. And Jefferson, moreover, is saying, how can the country work? How can a democracy work? How can people go to the polls and make intelligent decisions if we don't have a free press?
Well, there's that.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. This week I'm speaking with John Ragosta, who's a visiting professor at Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia. Today we're talking about Patrick Henry's role, not so much in the Revolution, but in our later constitutional history. After the break, we'll come back and speak some more with John Ragosta. Stay tuned. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue my conversation with John Ragosta. He's just recently written a book about Patrick Henry, and we're talking about that book today, but we're specifically focusing upon Henry's constitutional contributions.
The particular law, type of law that the Sedition Act was is commonly called the seditious libel law, or more broadly, a seditious defamation law, which is that you essentially can't criticize at all any kind, even truthful statements are often considered seditious defamation. So even if I'm very accurately say, you know, John Adams has done this or John Adams has done that, I can still be clapped into jail. So, John, I want to be very clear. People are going to jail. I mean, this is not just theoretical violation of the First Amendment. They're actually prosecuting people and putting them in jail, right?
That's right. There are dozens of people who are indicted. Many of them are sent to jail. There's been some recent scholarship. We used to say it was 14 people, I think, that were indicted. Turns out it's many, many more than that. It's probably over 100 when you include the sedition trials and the conspiracy to commit sedition trials. Matthew Lyons is the congressman from Vermont. Congressman is sent to jail for criticizing the president of the United States.
How does his constituents react?
It's fascinating. He's in jail, and they keep reelecting him. They call a special election to fill his slot. And the people of Vermont, in sort of a stick it to you, Washington, D.C., of course, it's not Washington, D.C. at that time, it's Philadelphia, but they keep reelecting him in spite of his being indicted for sedition. But this is how serious it is, and this is why Jefferson and Madison are apoplectic. They believe they cannot get relief in the courts because basically every judge is a Federalist. Because every judge had been appointed by either George Washington or John Adams.
Every federal judge, right.
Every federal judge.
Right. These are federal prosecutions, right.
These are federal prosecutions. So what should have been the solution, which is going to court and getting this declared unconstitutional, and by the way, Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, when debates were going on over the Constitution, said the courts will declare unconstitutional congressional actions that violate the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So that's not something the Supreme Court made up later. The people who were creating the Constitution were very much aware that that was the court's responsibility, was to intervene when Congress acted unconstitutionally. But in 1798, Jefferson and Madison are saying every judge is a Federalist. They're not going to declare this unconstitutional, and they don't. During all these prosecutions, people bring up the constitutionality, and the Federalist judges just look the other way.
That is a remarkable rejection of the concept of free speech. And I think we do well to remember this episode. I mean, people may have heard of the Alien and Sedition Acts, and they may have a general feeling that they were bad things. But now that we've put them into context, and now that we've emphasized people were being put in jail, politicians, congressmen are being put in jail simply for criticizing the government, people can recognize just how bad things had gotten by the end of the 1790s.
And that's why Jefferson and Madison, it's not just people are going to jail, but Jefferson's looking ahead and saying the country can't work. You can't have a democracy. If the press is not free to criticize, to investigate, to look into people's ties with foreign governments, for example, then the government doesn't work because the electorate is not informed.
So this was genuinely a constitutional crisis of the first magnitude.
This is absolutely a constitutional crisis. And again, a crisis because of the timing, we didn't have confidence in the independent judiciary. You have to have an independent judiciary. And at that time, you didn't, just because it was only 8 years old.
We've gotten really accustomed to the idea that the judiciary is going to protect us from anybody, any politician, the other two branches of the national government or the state government or the local governments, that the courts are going to stand there and protect us if people go so far as to violate our constitutional rights. They weren't doing it.
That's right. And that was expected. As I said, Jefferson and Madison and Henry all expected the courts to intervene if the Congress violated the Constitution. But it wasn't happening because you did not really have an independent judiciary yet, simply because everybody appointed had been Federalist. They were one party.
Very, very frightening time.
Right. So what do you do? Well, this is why Jefferson and Madison have what Jefferson thought was a brilliant idea of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. And essentially what that was the legislature in Kentucky and the legislature in Virginia adopted a series of resolutions that in essence said the states can declare congressional action unconstitutional.
The states can declare congressional action to be unconstitutional, commonly called nullification.
Nullification. And Jefferson actually uses the term nullification, which of course then becomes a banner for the South when we get to the Civil War. Madison doesn't like that word. Madison sort of recognizes that Jefferson's walking on a very thin ice. But the idea that the states have a role of intervening and nullifying federal laws that are unconstitutional.
Didn't Madison call interpositioning?
Interpositioning.
Yeah, exactly. Forgive me for interrupting here, but let's put it in context. People may wonder why Virginia and Kentucky. But Kentucky had been part of Virginia up until recently, right?
Right. So
it was natural if you're
Jefferson
in Virginia.
And Madison's homes.
Right.
Right. It's absolutely natural that Kentucky and Virginia, these have become sort of the states' rights states. And largely that's because of Jefferson and Madison.
And because of the historical connection between Virginia and Kentucky. Okay, so they decide that they are going to, whether you're listening to Jefferson or Madison, they're going to enlist the state legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky to do what? To pass resolutions?
They're going to pass resolution, and they basically say that these laws will have no force and effect in Virginia and Kentucky. So it's a direct challenge between the state's governments and the federal government.
Right.
And they actually send a letter to every other state legislature, to Pennsylvania, to Maryland, to New Jersey, to New Hampshire, and say, we want you to join, because if all of the states agree that these laws are unconstitutional, then that'll be the end of these laws. Well, the other state legislatures basically write back and say, are you crazy? We can't do that. The federal government, there's a supremacy clause in the Constitution. The supreme law of the land is federal law.
Right, Article 6. In fact, let's just pause there, because just as I was criticizing the Sedition Act as being in direct contravention of the First Amendment, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, if in fact they are read as true nullification, you know, declaring this law will not be enforced in this state by anybody, that they're truly attempting to nullify, they're in direct contravention of the Supremacy Clause, which is very explicit that the national law is going to be supreme, notwithstanding the Constitution or the state laws of any state, and all the judges in every state have to take an oath to support this Constitution. It's very, very clear. So if you interpret the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions as complete attempts at nullification, they were just as much in violation of the Constitution as the Sedition Act was.
Absolutely. And project forward 30 years, when South Carolina tries to nullify the tariff and Andrew Jackson's president, Andrew Jackson basically lets it be known that the first South Carolinian who interferes with enforcement of federal law, I'll hang the SOB.
And he had the arms to back it up, too.
Right, right. And people used to say, when Andrew Jackson starts talking about hanging people, you look for a tree and a piece of rope, because he means it.
I think he was our only president who served his terms with several pieces of lead still embedded in him from various duels. Andrew Jackson was not somebody you messed around with. Okay, so that's very, very important, because we've touched upon something, and by the way, we have talked about the subject of nullification. In fact, it was one of our very first episodes. It's fascinating, but that really is not the focus, strangely enough, of what we're talking about now. Maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe you have something to say about nullification itself, but I guess what I was trying to get at was that this was, in the context of the 1790s, was an extreme response to an extreme provocation.
Exactly. And that's why there's a constitutional crisis. The Congress seems to be ignoring the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. Jefferson and Madison of the Democratic Republicans seem to be ignoring the Sixth Article. Mm-hmm. And people are concerned. Get back to Patrick Henry. George Washington, living in retirement, in Mount Vernon, 1799, January 15th, 1799, writes a letter to Patrick Henry, living in retirement down on the North Carolina, Virginia border. And he's, in this letter, he basically says we have a constitutional crisis and that these people are going to destroy the Union. These people are going to destroy the government that you and I fought to create and that the revolution created. Well, these people were Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. So here's George Washington writing to Patrick Henry saying, you have to get back into politics to fight these people, Jefferson and Madison, who are going to destroy the nation because they're going to say the states can ignore the federal government. And that's not the government that we created.
But didn't George Washington realize where Patrick Henry's loyalties lay?
Well, that's what's interesting. I think George Washington knew better than Jefferson. People might have said, well, wait a minute, Patrick Henry's the great anti-federalist. He's going to agree with Jefferson and Madison. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened. That's not what happens. Henry says, you're absolutely right. He writes back to George Washington. He says, you're absolutely right. And he makes his final speech at Charlotte Courthouse. And in some ways, what he's saying in that speech is, I told you people, talking to the public, I told you people what was going to happen. I told you the federal government was going to be too powerful. I told you they were going to get out of line and they were going to interfere with your liberties. But this is what we agreed to. And the only way to fix it is at the ballot box. You don't go around ignoring federal law and asserting your right to ignore it just because you dislike what the federal government does. You have to go to the ballot box and do it properly. And he says at one point that Virginia is to the federal government exactly like Charlotte County is to Virginia. We have no more right to ignore the Virginia government than Virginia has a right to ignore the federal government.
What an evolution.
Absolutely.
And what a great summary. Just think about this. Henry says during the ratification debates, the federal government is going to oppress us. Lo and behold, there it is. 10 years later, the federal government oppressing people, taking away their free speech rights. And then people like Jefferson and Madison, arguably, are going in and trying to completely tear apart the structure of government, turn it on its head to protect those liberties. And then it's Henry, of all people, who comes in and says, okay, I told you so, but let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's not tear down the house in order to fix it. Let's just fix the house.
Exactly. And he says that, look, and he runs, this is a campaign speech. He's running to be elected to the Virginia legislature. The interesting thing is Henry wins, of course. Henry always wins when he runs for anything. He's very, very popular. He wins. He dies before he can take office.
Oh, my.
Had Henry lived, Jefferson would have never been elected president in 1800.
Really?
John Randolph, who's a great Jeffersonian, basically says, had Henry lived, Jefferson would have never been elected. And the reason for that is actually, back to a very presentist issue, they're playing with the Electoral College. Nobody knows quite how to work the Electoral College yet. It's still relatively new. And when the Constitution starts, the way the Electoral College worked was based on popular vote in each state. So Virginia has 14 votes. You decide how many votes Jefferson has, how many votes Adams has, and you allocate your 14 electoral votes based on the popular vote.
Proportionally.
It's proportional.
Right.
But somebody has figured out that, no, what we ought to do is if we really want to get our guy in the White House— is we ought to give all of our votes to whoever wins the vote in Virginia. So Jefferson's going to, because they know Jefferson's going to win in Virginia, we will give all of our votes to Jefferson, denying Adams the 3 or 4 votes that he probably would have gotten in Virginia.
In fact, that's probably what happened in 1796, is that Adams picked up a few votes in the South because of proportional representation in the Electoral College. Whereas the northern states were voting more in blocks with winner take all. And so Jefferson then fixed this from the southern perspective, right?
Right. It's in 1799. And had what Randolph is saying is had Patrick Henry lived, because everybody knew what was going on. Everybody knew that this was trying to get Jefferson elected.
Right.
Henry would have never let that happen. And Henry always won in the Virginia electoral politics. I mean, that if Henry had been opposed, they could have never gotten that through the House. So had Henry lived, by the way, had George Washington lived, George Washington dies in December of 1799,
right.
Jefferson probably would have never been elected.
Now, this gets a little confusing. I'll just simply refer people to a recent episode we did on the Electoral College, because that is, as you mentioned, such a concern for people these days. But just to recap it briefly, the Constitution says that there's going to be this thing called the Electoral College. It's going to be based upon the total number of representatives that every state has in both the House and the Senate. So you get a certain number of electoral votes for a given state. And the state legislature in each state gets to decide how those votes are going to be allocated. So every state legislature has the power to decide whether they're going to have proportional representation or whether they're going to have a winner-take-all system. And what happened was that some states in the North had figured out that if we all have a winner-take-all system, then all of our votes will go for a Northern candidate like John Adams, and maybe we'll pick up a few votes in the South because they're so dumb down there, they're going to have proportional representation. And that's exactly what happened. Adams picked up a few Southern votes. He beats Jefferson in 1796. So now he's the president, and we have all these problems with the Alien and Sedition Act. So it's in response to that, sort of this Electoral College arms race, that Jefferson is going to change Virginia and, by leadership, some other Southern states to a winner-take-all system, which ultimately allows him to prevail barely over a Northerner, Aaron Burr.
Right, in 1800. Well, and of course, over Adams.
Oh, Adams just gets creamed. Yeah, but even the fellow he ultimately ties with in the Electoral College is Aaron Burr. Who happens to be from New York. I know he's on the same ticket and all the rest of it, but there's that northern-southern thing going on.
The Electoral College, as people may think of it, as complicated, but as I point out in my book, again, this new book, Patrick Henry Proclaiming a Revolution, it's pretty clear that had Henry lived, Jefferson would not have been elected. And it's all because of this constitutional crisis. And both sides really have a point here. I mean, Madison and I don't want to be too critical of Madison and Jefferson. They're looking at the Sedition Act saying this is a clear violation of the First Amendment, free speech, free press. The country can't work without free speech and free press. And on the other side, you have George Washington and Patrick Henry saying the country can't work if states are going to simply ignore federal authority and people, when you don't like a law, you just ignore it, which was right. In essence what Jefferson and Madison were doing.
And since the courts weren't available to fix it, they were coming up with these extreme responses.
It's a very extreme response, and Henry gets back into politics. And once again, he had done this at the end of the ratification convention. Once again in 1799, Patrick Henry, loyal opposition, the way you do it is you go to the ballot box, you elect congressmen, you elect senators, and you fix it through the normal legal process.
It sounds like Patrick Henry grew and changed with the circumstances in a very thoughtful manner. So you've convinced me. I hope you convince lots of people to go out and buy your book. And what's the name of the book again, John?
It's Patrick Henry Proclaiming a Revolution. It's a relatively short biography. I'm doing some additional work on Patrick Henry, I hope in the next year or two. But really taking this man who was extremely important in the Revolution and in these early years, in the 1790s, he dies in 99, very, very important, who we've tended to forget.
Thank you very much for telling us about your new book. Everybody should run out and buy 15 copies, and we'll talk again sometime.
I'll look forward to it. Thanks, you, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to John Ragosta for telling us about Patrick Henry and his important contributions to American constitutional history. If you want to read more, go out and get his new book, Patrick Henry, Proclaiming a Revolution. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.